Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, new and regular listeners. It's great to have you all here. Thank you for tuning in today. I hope you've had a good day so far. My name is Henrik from Sweden, and I started this radio show in 2006, and we've been going strong ever since, covering all kinds of topics and looking into different aspects of conspiracies, cover-ups, the agendas of the elite of this world, and many other topics. We are not afraid to investigate uncomfortable issues to find answers and find out what really is going on in this world. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com. That is the websites where we have more for you. Radio shows, videos, news, commentary, and much more. Also, I hope to see you in San Mateo at the end of June, by the way, for the Secret Space Program Conference. I am going to be hosting that one, and we have some great speakers there as well. It's the event of the year, for sure. So please go to secretspaceprogram.org or find the links from our websites. And by the way, if you're a member, check out the members ticket discount as well. Today we're talking with Acharya S, a.k.a. DM Murdoch, a very interesting discussion ahead of us here on the myth of Moses, Judaism, religious mythology, monotheism, the Abrahamic virus, and also later, a whole lot more, as our conversation goes into the current ongoing cultural genocide that we are seeing in Europe and the West. This is a part of this program that you should not miss. Acharya is an independent scholar of comparative religion and mythology, specializing in the ancient astrotheological origins of popular religious systems and beliefs. DM Murdoch was classically educated, receiving an undergraduate degree in classics, Greek civilization, from Franklin and Marshall College. She's a member of the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, Greece. She is also well-traveled and speaks, reads, and writes English, Greek, French, Spanish, Italian, German, Portuguese, and a smattering of other languages to varying degrees. She has gained expertise in several religions, as well as knowledge about the esoterica and mystical subjects. DM is the author of several books, including The Christ Conspiracy, Sons of God, Who Was Jesus, and Christ in Egypt. Today, primarily in the first hour, we are going to talk about her latest book, Did Moses Exist?, and get deeper into the question of origins, specifically of the tribes that formulated the myth that later became the basis for the myth of Moses and the Bible at large. Welcome, Acharya, a.k.a. also writing under the name DM Murdoch. It's great to have you back again. It's been way too long since we had you on the program, so thanks for returning.
Oh, it's great to be here. It's always nice to have conversation with you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Same with you, Acharya. So you cover such a lot of interesting material in this latest book. You've done an excellent job laying the story out. Just tell us a little bit more why you wanted to tackle Moses. Was this kind of a logical progression, considering the other work that you've been doing in the field, or any other reasoning for this?
Well, what happened is that I was doing a second edition of my book, The Christ Conspiracy, which has been somewhat popular in the past 15 years and needed some revision based on the fact that I can now use fabulous state-of-the-art methodology, technological wonders like the internet and search features and so forth. And so I was updating that book, and I thought, you know, I have all this really great information in all of my books about Moses, and I see people discussing this. Of course, every once in a while there's a new movie, or a movie is being promoted, or, you know, so on and so forth, because this is a constant, shall we say, brainwashing that we're under.
Yeah.
I mean, it's relentless. Every year at Christmas, every year at Easter, there's a new program, there's a new movie, there's a new book, there's a new discovery, you know? And they always time it for these holidays to get everybody all riled up and get them back into the faith. And as you probably are aware, there's a massive falling away from taking the Bible literally around the world in most of the westernized places, shall we say.
Yeah.
There's a lot of apostasy going on. There's people calling themselves nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not Christian nuns. And just an extraordinary amount of secularism, and, of course, atheistic thoughts are becoming more popular and so forth. And so people are becoming more skeptical of this material. And I thought, well, I can show that Moses, as I did in, as I've done with Jesus, I can show that Moses is a fictional compilation of characters largely based on ancient myths. And I had discussed this in some detail previously in these other writings. So I started to just collect some of my writings together, and that just snowballed. And now there's like just a tiny percentage of what I had collected from my other writings, and most of it is, the vast majority of it is fresh research. And of course, once I started opening that can of worms, everybody and his brother was coming out and saying, well, what about this? What about Akhenaten? What about Santorini's eruption? What about the tempest's delay? What about, you know, I mean, I was like, oh my goodness, there are 1,000 different strains of thought. And then there's the whole aliens thing. And
yep.
So I started a thread on my forum, and it ended up to be, you know, dozens of pages long with over the last couple of years while I was doing this research, and people would come in with their theories, and I went back and forth with a lot of this material, and I scrutinized it. And so what I've done is taken pretty much everything that came my way. Some things right at the last minute were thrown up. It was just, that's why it took so long, because I just was going to put together this short booklet. And it's a 600-page
book. That happened.
But I'm glad I did it. It was grueling. I'm so happy that it's published, but I'm glad I went into it so deeply, because what it's done is flesh out the ancient world in such a way as I don't think anyone has ever painted this picture before. And the picture that came out of it is so absolutely fascinating. It's even more interesting than, it's far more interesting to me than what, than this shallow depiction in the Bible. If we were to take that literally as history, has this kind of cartoonish depiction of the ancient world where there's just a bunch of clowns doing crazy stuff, and then the real God came and he established his law, and that's really important, and the rest was just nonsense, and these other cultures were bad and evil, and the Egyptians. I still see that, this Egyptian anti-Egyptian bigotry.
Oh, yeah.
The Egyptians were practicing evil things,
yep,
and needed Moses to straighten them out.
Yeah, isn't that, it's very interesting, actually. And obviously, I want to talk more about what kind of image emerged and everything else here. But did Moses exist? That's the title of the book, subtitled The Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver. Obviously, then, this is a central figure in the entire story of not only Israel and Judaism, but the Christian faith as well, as you outlined. I do not know how much of a central role at all he is to Islam, so if that would encompass then all of the Abrahamic religions per se. But tell us a little bit about what we should know about Moses, for those who missed, you know, Sunday school, I guess. When did this alleged man/Superman lived? You know, what are some of the deeds he accomplished? Maybe you can summarize him a little bit for us.
Sure. Well, the you know, as far as the time frame goes, that's what's been so indicative that we're talking about a myth. There have been, since antiquity, there have been different dates put forth. One of the most famous is, I think it's like the 15th century. Jerome wanted that date for, and then they based it on certain verse in the scriptures. And there's been so many dates put forth. And when you start seeing that kind of, you know, mushy wishy-washiness, then you start to think, I wonder if this is not a mythical tale. But the, you know, the most popular is the 13th century, and people are trying to say that the pharaoh of the story is Ramses II. So that's where the historization lies at this point, is somewhere around the 13th century. Supposedly, this Moses figure was born to a Jewish family, Jewish woman, who, you know, there was the classic archetypal story of the persecution of the firstborn children, and some, you know, this is so classic. You find that in the story of Jesus and Sargon and Krishna, and it's just classic. The hero was born, the hero with 1,000 faces, right? He's born, and there's some danger, and so he's put into a river. Again, this is a story of Sargon from the 3rd millennium BC in Sumeria. and fished out of the river by the Egyptian pharaoh's daughter, and then she raises him as her child. And then, you know, we see this great battle between Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. And, and it's, you know, it's so funny about that classic Ten Commandments movie from Hollywood, of course, with those two stars, is that in the story, the pharaoh would be like 90 years old and Moses and Aaron were 80 and 83. And so that's who would be running through the desert, a 90-year-old man chasing an 80-year-old man.
Right.
And yet they're depicted with, you know, Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner. Yul Brynner's the 90-year-old pharaoh. That's what would, if we were to keep that in the time frame of the 13th century, the pharaoh would be 90 years old. So in any event, that's the story. Then Moses takes his people after a series of plagues. Well, he figures out that he's Jewish. And so he's saying, Pharaoh, let my people go. And he gets that information from the burning bush when he's exiled into the desert. And then he comes back to Egypt to free his people. And then the Pharaoh, whose heart is hardened by Yahweh, the Jewish God, who sent a series of plagues, the 10 plagues, to torture the Egyptians. And, you know, there's all that miraculous supernatural stuff going
on. Sure, yeah.
Which would have pretty much decimated the entire country many times over and had a reverberating effect throughout the entire Mediterranean, because Egypt was very powerful at the time. But anyway, so then the story is that he takes his 600,000 warriors, and first they're slaves, now they're warriors, go figure. But the pitiful slaves suddenly become warriors overnight. And then there's some possibly 2 to 3 million people would be accompanying him, marching through a desert that's 130 miles wide. And for some peculiar reason, they get lost and for 40 years in the desert and can't find their way just across the border to the promised land. They justify this 40-year sojourn as the period when Yahweh is trying to essentially brainwash his followers into his law, which is a very strict, very difficult, very cruel and brutal way of living. And so, you know, of course the followers won't submit. And so there's just an endless stream of miracles and punishments and constant communication with Moses and Aaron in a tent. You know, the God of the cosmos comes and has a series of conversations for a period of 40 years with Moses and Aaron in a small tent in the desert. Yeah, okay. And so then eventually, right at the border of the promised land, Moses keels over and Joshua and Caleb are the only two people originally left of the original Israelites at that point. They bring the descendants into, who are oddly the exact same number as the ones who left, they bring the descendants into the promised land, and then there's the whole conquest, and that moves into beyond the Pentateuch, or the first five books of Moses in the Bible, and that's basically where my book ends as well.
Well, there we go. Wow, thank you for that outline. Okay, so that kind of that kind of summarizes some of the things that you've been tackling here, obviously. So let's just kind of head right into it and attempt to explain some of this. I mean, obviously, when you talk about this stuff, it's like I'm so intrigued with the ideas of origins of where do the ideas come from? How did they originate? Were they simply transformed from earlier, mythologies? Were they borrowed? Was it truly people who had visions for whatever reason, you know, religious experiences, hallucinogenics? I mean, there's a number of ways, of course, we can explain all this. How did you approach these topics of origins and what they actually went through, if they even were there at all, of course?
Well, one thing I consistently came upon were the parallels between the Moses myth and other mythologies and belief systems of the region, and the immediately striking. Of course, the birth narrative I've already explained has parallels in other cultures and is widely accepted to be a mythical motif of, you know, the abandoned child in a body of water is quite classic story. And so then looking, if I even start with that particular motif and look at it, then I start discovering, well, this appears to be a solar myth, and fishing the god out of the water, or the god man or the hero or whatever, out of the water, especially the Nile, is straight out of Egyptian mythology with the god Horus, who is a sun god in the morning, Raharakti, rising out over the Nile River, looking as if he's coming out of the marshes. And so immediately we have a sun god being drawn from the water. And knowing the difference between my research, I think the biggest difference between my research and what you find with people who are constantly trying to historicize these stories, whether they're, you know, he was a real man and he actually had supernatural powers, or he was an mm-hmm. alien, or, yep. you know, or he was a crackpot, but he was always a real man. The major difference between these depictions and mine is that I have a pretty massive background in mythology over the last like 50 years, if you count childhood, which is when I became fascinated by mythology.
Yeah.
And so I can see a myth because I know other mythology, which we accept as mythology. You know, nobody's going to be trying to argue that Hercules was a real person or that Osiris was a real person. There are some people who say, well, we've got tombs of Osiris, therefore, well, the operative word there is tombs with an S. The reason we have multiple tombs is because he's a mythical figure and people were just setting up tombs so that they could claim that Osiris was here and we are the priesthood of his in this town or in this city or in right. this village or this location. And so in any event, studying mythology as myths from, you know, the great mythologist Joseph Campbell, we should have learned much about mythology, but everybody seems to have forgotten him.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, of course, I studied not only his works, but many others, the Greek myths. I read them in their original texts. I've read Homer in original ancient Greek, which is not an easy read. And knowing that these are mythical creatures, they're not real people that were, the depiction of the ancient world would be absurd with just running around all these supernatural beings it's like straight out of some sci-fi movie. So, but anyway, so knowing that background, then when I see motifs like that are clearly not historical, like crossing bodies of water and so forth, then I think, well, hey, that is obviously a mythical motif. Where does it come from? And I know that it appears in other myths. And what does it mean? And when we know about the background of nature worshiping and what we're calling now astrotheology or astral mythology, solar mythology, lunar mythology, when you know that information, then you can start seeing these motifs in as for what they really mean. Some of them can be traced back tens of thousands of years, possibly, depending on the location. And so that's what differentiates my work. I can see these motifs. I can tell you where they come from. I can tell you what other cultures had them and what they mean and why they were passed along, how it ended up that way, what were the environmental forces that sculpted these myths, and so on and so forth. And like I say, the world that they reveal, that is revealed with this less literal view, is actually much more interesting. Now you don't have to think, well, the Canaanites were all evil, the Egyptians were all evil, the Babylonians were all evil, the Assyrians were all evil. You know, this is the impression the Bible gives us, everybody's evil except for the Israelites. And in fact, when you read what the Israelites did, it was they who come across as being evil, because it's an endless stream of slaughter and rape and just horrible things, you know, that are being depicted. Like Moses, for example, who wants to take this guy as a great hero? He's depicted in Numbers 31 as slaughtering 30,000 Midianites. And then when his men are done, he says, "Have you left the women alive?" And then he sends them back to murder all the women.
Right.
Why is anyone running around saying this is a great man of God? You know?
Well, exactly. I mean, the Bible is, to a certain extent, I've heard other commentaries say that it was written as a war document, obviously. But even how are you interpreting even these things then? Is it partially just a worldview that is supplanted, but nothing of it actually happened? Or, for example, in the cases that you just brought up in terms of the war with some of the other tribes, nearby mm-hmm. territories, Are these battles and things that actually did occur, do you believe?
Well, yes, and this is some of how we can date these texts, because, for example, the Midianites didn't even exist until the first millennium, and so this person couldn't be fighting them in the second millennium, which is what,
right.
You know, I mean, so all these anachronisms crop up that are reflective of the politics of the day. And even though the sentiment may be part of the political agenda, they aren't necessarily historical. For example, I doubt that anyone went and slaughtered 30,000 Midianites. However, the political parties of the day when this was probably written, that part of it, not the whole thing, but that part of it, maybe the 8th or 7th century, when Hezekiah and other kings are depicted, Josiah are depicted as rampaging, you know, to establish Yahweh's supremacy, that they would have these ancient hatreds of neighboring tribes come up. And I mean, it's ludicrous because in the Bible story, Moses is married to the head of the Midianites' daughter. Jethro is a high priest of the Midianites, and his daughter is married to Moses. So why then is he going and rampaging, slaughtering all the Midianites? Well, if we look forward five or so centuries, then we can see that there was an agenda at the time of attacking the Midianites. And the ludicrous thing about all that fighting is that these are all related peoples. Most of them were all Semites from similar tribes or the same tribes. The one thing that I think is clearly established in my book is the Amoritish origins of the Israelites. The Amorites were a kingdom of Semites who were West Semite speakers like the Canaanites and the Phoenicians, and they moved over into the Babylonian region and took over, and that's how the Sumerian myths became Semiticized, so to speak. They adopted the Sumerian mythology into this Canaanite framework, and then it became the Babylonian, the Amoritish Babylonians. And from there, you will find many myths that are the basis of the stories that we find in the Pentateuch. These are the first five books of the Bible that are attributed to Moses. So in my book, I start off with dissecting the so-called historicity of these tales. And I show, because, you know, the Pentateuch is attributed to Moses, and yet he is depicted as portraying his own death and where he's buried. And so we can dissect these writings and say, you know, this person, Moses, did not write them. It becomes quite blatantly obvious. Some of this material was not even, it couldn't have been in existence until possibly as late as the second half of the first millennium, or the third, fourth, fifth centuries, sixth centuries. You know, that's when these stories start showing up. We have a group of Jews in Elephantine Egypt in the 5th century. There's a whole pile of papyruses from there. And I believe they're in Aramaic, and I discuss this in my book. They seem to have absolutely no idea of any kind of Moses figure in their writings.
Mm-hmm.
There's no mention of an exodus. There's no conquest. There's none of this iconography is present in these writings. And they're specifically addressing the Jerusalem priesthood and asking about religious issues. And you can see that the story is that Moses receives this law and then he imposes it upon the Jewish people and they bring it in and live by it. But then you see in the later stories, supposedly later stories, or actually earlier, that the Israelites are depicted as whoring after this god and that goddess, and they're constantly engaging in polytheistic behaviors, and the frustrated Yahweh supremacists have to go and slaughter them all and destroy their high places and their places of worship and ruin their cults. You know, this is what we see over and over again, which is indicative that that tale of Yahweh 40 years in the desert programming people, supposedly initiating the recitation, you know, the recital of the law every 7 years, they were supposed to recite the law. The whole group of the cultists, all were supposed to know this law by heart. And yet we see these stories in from the 7th century, supposedly, where the law has been lost, and it's been lost for like 600 years. And you think, well, where was Yahweh during that time when the law was lost? And
right.
You know, they're just kind of trying to cover up the tracks that they were actually Canaanites and they were polytheistic, and that didn't happen. So there's this huge gap where, you know, it's just like, well, they were polytheistic during that entire time. Never heard of Moses, barely heard of Yahweh, who, by the way, I trace the origins as best as we know. The research that I did here was all based on the most scientific viewpoints that we have at this time in history, the archaeology, the primary sources, or the lack thereof, you know, anything that would come, even the study of viniculture and viticulture would prove to be incredibly instrumental. It would be, you know, grape growing and winemaking. I have a whole chapter on the vine and wine, which shows that they intertwined quite a bit of wine myths into the story of Moses. In fact, one of the things I kept stumbling upon was this correspondence between Moses and the Greek wine god Dionysus, which is hugely influential. The story that we have, I have like something like 50 points of correspondences between the myth of Dionysus and the story of Moses, as in the Old Testament.
Well, that's interesting. That's very different, of course, because we have very different ideas about the traits of Dionysus. At least I do when I think about it.
Yeah.
And Moses is like diametrically opposed. So, pull that together a little bit for us.
Right. Well, in my book, I have a very lengthy chapter on, first I go into the lawgiver archetype, and we discover that there have been many different lawgivers, including Dionysus, and that they are depicted as receiving the law on the mountain from the great high god. In the case of Hammurabi, the law, the code of Hammurabi, was given to him by the high god, the sun god, Shamash. And so that's pretty important. And Gilgamesh and Ur-Nammu of Sumeria, very old legislator, all these myths. And so, you know, so we already have several aspects of the archetype in even before Dionysus shows up in the scene, somewhere around the second half of the second millennium. So, you know, maybe 1300, 1400, all of a sudden now we find the name Dionysus and his more Greek influence. The wine god is traceable to a period before that time, of course. There's goddesses as well, wine goddesses. Wine has been possibly made for 6,000 years in different areas, up in Thrace and in Persia and other places. They've been finding remains of winemaking. And so one would suspect that there was a divinity attached to the wine god long before his name became Dionysus. I also trace the name of Dionysus, by the way. It's possibly Sumerian. So there were Sumerian gods and goddesses of wine. And they're also solar, because the sun and the grapes go hand in hand. And wine was much more important than people realize. I didn't even realize. When I started looking into it, I was like, holy moly. The wine industry really drove a lot of commerce for thousands of years all around the Mediterranean. It was massively important, and people who were involved in it were extremely wealthy. Hmm. And as we know, you know, the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules.
Sure, yeah.
So wealthy wine merchants were determining policy all over the place. And so by the time, you know, Dionysus became, when the Greek culture started to dominate, Dionysus became the big god that really dominated. They had Dionysian theaters all over the Mediterranean where his plays, and these are proselytizing plays, they're not just something that we'd watch like Shakespeare or whatever. These were instructions on how to be a good follower, a devotee of Dionysus. And this was this was happening all over the place in Spain and Italy and Libya and Egypt in the Levant.
Right.
And of course, Thrace and Macedonia and Turkey, all those regions were being proselytized by Dionysus. And so we discover that his attributes in this myth, one of the first things I just kept running across in some of the older scholarship, and the value of the older scholarship is that these scholars actually studied the ancient texts in their original languages. It was de rigueur to know Greek and Latin. And it was also imperative that they read the works of Strabo and Josephus and Diodorus and Herodotus and Hesiod and Homer and anything that was in Greek and Latin from antiquity. These people knew it. They knew it inside and out. I'm talking about from the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. That was part of their standard education. And we know back then, of course, it was largely the elite who would be educated.
Yep.
Because it was very expensive. Poor people were not educated. There was no public schools like we have now that are free or taxpayer.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing is free.
Yeah. <I know. laughs> And so these people were the wealthy elitists, the scholars, and they were well educated. So derogating them because they came a couple centuries ago in this field is really inappropriate and egregious. There is not a lot of the new research comes with the ability today to be able to search through texts in multiple languages and to be able to really dig into the original writings in their, original languages. That's our improvement and archaeological discoveries since then. But otherwise, the information is not dated because it relies on these ancient texts, which too few people know today. There's not a lot of people reading Greek, ancient Greek. There's not a lot of people reading Latin and even learning that. And these are the two things throughout my book. I use these primary sources wherever I can find them in whatever language because I have that ability with languages. So there's like 20 different languages in this book. But I put it in such a way that you can understand them. I think that it's easy for the lay reader to follow along. It's not meant to be intimidating. It's meant to give, where are the sources? Everybody's always asking for the sources. Well, yeah. They're here. I got them. I've got a study guide as well available that has even more sources in it. But I kept coming across these comparisons between Bacchus or Dionysus and Moses. And I have a chapter with just dozens of people dating back 2,000 years and then into a more modern period, starting like in the 16th century, making these parallels between Moses and Dionysus. And they do it repeatedly. And in the modern era when they're doing this, they're mostly Christian authorities, and they are, they're trying to uphold the Bible as God's literal word. So they're flabbergasted and flummoxed and not a little peeved that the ancients, the pagans obviously ripped off the Bible. That's the perspective.
Yeah.
That's the perspective that they took. These filthy pagans stole all of the myths and they told them about Dionysus and it was really Moses' myth originally. But when you start to look at it and you realize, well, that can't be, because in reality, Dionysus shows up in the literary record long before Moses. Doesn't matter how they fudge the time frame. We can backdate anything. If I'm writing about Shakespeare in the 16th century, it doesn't mean that he's alive now,
so sure, yeah.
That's basically what we're backdating these things. And so as it turns out, clearly the Dionysian archetypal mythos occurred first, and many of the elements are traceable to even older wine and sun gods. And so we're turning this older scholarship on its ear, and that started to happen too in the 19th century. People started to say, now wait a second, we don't believe that the Bible was ripped off. We believe the Bible copied the pagan myths.
Yeah.
That great age of enlightenment and rationalism that struck, and then came out of Great Britain and England. US. And they all also built on other European humanism out of Holland and Germany with the great Bible criticisms that happened there. So the higher school of criticism, higher criticism. And so all that was percolating. And there was then this switch to say, look, it looks like the Moses myth is predicated upon Dionysus rather than the other way around. So I can give you some of the attributes of Dionysus that we can, that I put together, and I've got 46 of them in a list in a chapter called Life of Dionysus.
Yeah.
The Bacchic attributes. And they are all cited with the ancient primary sources like Cicero and Pausanias and Diodorus and Homer and Apollodorus and Philostratus and Euripides and Macrobius. All these I've got. The research that to dig up all of these motifs in the original languages, and I repeat some of the Greek in there too to show people that it was quite a bit of work. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
To associate, you know, not just take a paragraph that somebody had put together 200 years ago, but to actually break it down and find the original primary sources that they were referring to. I'll give you an example. Okay. Like the Hebrew prophet, Dionysus was said to be born in or near Egypt, reflected in the epithet Nilus or of the Nile. So he was called Dionysus of the Nile. He was saved from the waters in a small box or a chest. He has an epithet of Mises, which is very similar to Moses. The Greek god was said to be bimater or had to have two mothers like Moses. He was brought up near a mountain in Arabia called Nisa, which is a transposition of Sinai.
Yeah.
Sina. He was married to Venus, and Moses' wife Zipporah is apparently also a name for Venus, one of the seven sisters. Let's see. They both had children. They fled a tyrant. Moses had a burning bush. Dionysus was called the fire because he was a solar hero. He had a magical rod. Dionysus had a magical rod that he could turn into a serpent. And just like Moses had a staff that he turned into a serpent. And then Dionysus's magical rod was wrapped with snakes like the Caduceus. And then we have the story of Moses raising up a brazen serpent pole. So there's a whole serpent god motif underlying this as well that I discuss in the book. And then there's different pestilences. Dionysus also causes plagues. It drives people crazy. If you didn't believe in Dionysus, you were smote with a disease in your private parts, which was similar to the hemorrhoids of Yahweh. First Samuel 5:9 and 6:4-5, he's talking about smiting the disbelievers with hemorrhoids.
Right.
So we also have Dionysus flees with an army of men and women, and he flees across the Ruddy Sea, which is the Red Sea. So you have that myth. You have Dionysus appears as a column of fire, or he uses fire to guide his troops through the desert, through India, which is in the east. And then we have a battle where, even in the Bible, Pharaoh is called the dragon, and Dionysus is attacking Pentheus, who is called the serpent. So there's this whole battle between the hero and the serpent, or the snake, or the dragon, or the Leviathan. And it has a lot to do with the sun and storm god and the ocean and controlling the murky waters. And that's the division of the sea. And you can find the germ of these tales in the Old Testament, for example, in the Song of the Sea, Exodus 15. You can see how it develops. They have this old tale, and this old tale then that has been changed by these Hebrews or Israelites to reflect this battle between the great god or the hero, the divine hero, and some kind of watery serpent monster, chaos monster. This goes back to Marduk and Tiamat. Then we also have it in the Canaanite mythology. And you can see that this template has been built upon. So it's a mythical archetype that has been built upon and added to and turned into the story of Moses and the Exodus and the crossing of the Red Sea and the battling of the Pharaoh, who's called Dragon. And then they keep adding details, and then they add a whole pile of details from the story of Gilgamesh. And there's a bunch of details from the story of Dionysus, which brings me back to crossing the Red Sea. And he divides, Dionysus is depicted as dividing the different rivers with his, and crossing it with his, he divides it with the wand, his magic wand. And then he drowns his enemies. There's also a companion. Dionysus had a companion who was a dog. And Moses' companion, Caleb, his name means dog in Hebrew. There's all kinds of details like this, killing giants. You know, we got Moses and the giants of the Philistines and the Amalekites and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it goes on and on like this. And the some of these themes are blatantly nature worshiping. They have to do with the sun. They have to do with constellations like the dog star. They have to do with wine and other natural forces. And that's why they're so similar stories. But they're definitely not history. That's the final conclusion.
So,
Yeah,
okay. Let me ask you this, though. The Israelites, obviously, then pulled together from a lot of different sources at different times as well, borrowing also plagiarism. And it sounds also like some of the issues that you mentioned earlier of conquest is obviously something that spread to other parts of the world later. But the, it's always interesting to try to get to the question of not only, of course, what the motivations are at the same time, but obviously the author of, if you've formulated any kind of picture of who actually pulled this together, we can focus on the Pentateuch, you know, first here, of course. But just the concepts of you know, the, it seems like Yahweh, in a sense, then was at that time was kind of pulled together by some mm-hmm. of them, right? They just decided, mm-hmm. okay, we need to reform the theology of our times, right? We need to do something new. Mm-hmm. So how are we any closer to that question?
Oh yeah, it's quite interesting, and I spend a lot of time on the origins of Yahweh in my book as well. There's a whole chapter on Yahweh and the sun, S-U-N, showing a great deal of solar mythology, but also the origins of where this God concept came from and how it started. He started out as a tribal God of, not the greatest character. This tribe in particular, the Shasu of Yahweh, is probably one of the major origins of this concept.
And are they different from the Amorites that you mentioned before?
Yes, but they are the Amorites. So the Amorites are this mass of people who they speak an Amoritish language, but that language is changed. They move around the Levant. They go into Babylon, and then they move back east. So now they're in Edom and Moab. And then they cross over.
And that's not because they were enslaved. They were nomads by default and moving around in different areas. And they weren't taken there.
Right. Well, yes, this was a huge mass of, a lot of them were nomadic to begin with. And then some of them settled. And then they would have these nomads living on the fringes of the society who were brigands and basically terrorists. You know, they would just go and take what they wanted, or they would rampage through settled communities, and so they were predators. These are the fringy nomadic, they were called Habiru or Habiru,
Habiru, yeah, Habiru, yeah.
Habiru or Apiru, which is different from the Hebrews, the Ibri. They have similar genealogy, but the names are not reflective of each other. However, the tribes where the Hebrews did end up emanating from were largely Amoritish Habiru. And so there is a connection there, but not the words don't derive from each other, the names. But the Habiru largely come from this Amoru kingdom, which is just east of the Canaanite coastal region Byblos and where the Phoenicians were. And the Phoenicians had been there a long time, and they had been empowered by the Egyptians because of the trees, you know, the great cedars of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
These cedars were used as far back as the early dynasties of Egypt to build not necessarily ships, because the Egyptians weren't all that seafaring, but the Phoenicians certainly were building ships at that point. But they were used in great building projects, these huge trees. You know, they were used also for tombs and for whatever temples and pyramids were being created. So there was a long-term cultural exchange going on between the Phoenicians and the Egyptians that predates all of this that we're discussing now. And so the Phoenicians were quite powerful. And these Amoritish tribes to the east wanted that. They wanted the cedars of Lebanon. You can see this desire reflected in the story of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh is a big Amorite hero. When the Amorites moved into the Babylonian region and took over from the Sumerians, they basically took their entire culture over and just kind of changed it to this more Semitic brand, which became the Babylonians. They created Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh contributed significantly to the Moses myth as well. This even older strain than the Dionysus archetype. And I do have a whole section on comparisons between Moses and Gilgamesh as well.
Right.
And you raised up the question of Moses in the Quran. And interestingly enough, validating this correspondence between Gilgamesh and Moshe, which is the Hebrew name for Moses. Moshe. The Quranic or the Islamic Moses has very blatant characteristics from the Gilgamesh myth. And so this kept going, you know. It wasn't just, I think some of this stuff has been lost, obviously, but so it wasn't just didn't end where this correspondence between Moses and Gilgamesh in the first millennium BC. It carried on into the Common Era, and is reflective in Islamic doctrine.
Interesting.
So So there's a fascinating thing. So we have the Babylonians, the Amoritish Babylonians, developing the Gilgamesh myth, and in the Gilgamesh myth, in the later strata, there's an earlier Sumerian, and there's an Akkadian, and there's Babylonian versions of this story, which was massively popular around that region. So it had to be influential on pretty much everyone. The children were learning it. We know from Canaanite texts found at Ugarit that children were learning the Gilgamesh epic in school. And so it was extremely important. But in some of these strata, we find the Babylonian or Amoritish writers of it make the story where the hero goes to the mountains where the cedars are. They want that mountain. They want those trees. They want that sort of resource to empower themselves and become rich. And they're expressing it in this epic. And so you can see all the different political agendas, and then when in the about 50, I think it's 1595, the Amorites were evicted from Babylon, and then they were pushed west again.
Do you know why they were evicted? Is there any details about that?
Yeah, I think it was the Akkadians. They were just detestable brigands who had, you know, caused so much warfare. They'd been battling and taking over peoples and lands and slaughtering and so forth. And eventually they just got rid of as many as they could. They moved into these more western regions like Moab, and then across the Jordan back into, you know, the Israel Canaanite region. And that's before it was called Israel, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
And so some of them, they're breaking up into tribes. Some of them end up in Moab and Edom down in the southern region. And this is where you see the Shasu showing up. They're not entirely restricted to that, because there are some western Shasu as well. But there's this eastern Shasu group. The Shasu are, these are the nomads who were also evicted. They were taken, some of them were taken prisoners and of war and enslaved in Egypt. And this is where people think, well, that's obviously where the Exodus story comes from. And I agree that in their folklore, it's probably they would have made, this is probably does explain why they changed these myths to reflect Egypt as the bad guy and that they were, you know, there were slaves in Egypt, is that some of these proto-Israelites, they would be called,
right,
the Shasu, they had this god apparently called Yahweh, but we can find inferences in the Amoritish or the Canaanitish mythology also of Yahweh as the son of El, the high god.
Mm-hmm.
I go into all the details of this. Nobody needs to remember this, although you can certainly listen to this show over and over again. So we have all these different strains of Semites. We have the Hapiru, the Amorites. They're all Amoritish, basically.
So that's a group over encompassing name for all of the different Semitic speaking people and tribes, basically.
At a certain point, because they had moved around so much, they incorporated so many different people, but it is a Western Semitic movement in particular. Eastern Semitic, of course, would be Arabic and
right,
Akkadian and so forth.
Yeah.
But this is largely Western Semitic, and this explains why we find Western Semites even in the East, because these Babylonian Amoritish people were moving all over the place.
And this is what we know from history, of course. I mean, let's look at all the different migration periods that have been ongoing. I mean, even the conquest, as you said, to give a little bit of fairness in that regard, the behavior is, of course, much more commonplace at that time than what we would think of it today, for example. This is something that just took place, right? This is part of human nature to a certain extent, even if we like that or not, right?
Yes. One of the things I emphasize when we're talking about Exodus, the Exodus, there have been thousands of exoduses out of Egypt, because that's a bottleneck right there. If you want to leave Africa, you have two choices. You go through that region or you go across water.
Yeah.
But that's about it, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's this whole out of Africa theory with DNA, and you know, that's all up in the air still. But there's clearly,
sure,
there's been a lot of people coming out of Africa across that area. And they have to cross. I'm sure they crossed the Red Sea in boats, and possibly in times where it was shallower in the marshy area to the north. And of course, they crossed over that whole Gaza region and the Sinai. And so that's been a back and forth, back and forth. There's been tons of traffic going through there. So there's been thousands of exoduses. And with all that movement, again, now if you want to go up into Europe, unless you go by boat, you're going to have to pass through what is now called Israel, or Jordan, or Syria, rather, and then up into Turkey. And so you have just massive movements of people, possibly, if not many tens of thousands of years ago, it could be even a couple hundred thousand years ago, that anthropologists are saying that they found Homo sapiens teeth that are 400,000 years old in Israel.
Mm.
And so, you know, you're talking these movements, and back in the day when before they had fortified cities, or when the technology was, I mean, a lot of these cultures didn't have great technology. Some did, Egypt. Then we had even older ones like Göbekli Tepe.
Right.
But Jericho was very old. And then there's Çatalhöyük. There's these wonderful, amazing sites that are mind-boggling to light.
That's right.
And they show high development. But they're also, just as you say, constant battling between tribes. And since the majority of the people in that region were Semites for most of the time, the period that we're talking about, there were also the Hurrians, who are not even Indo-European. They're non-Semitic, non-Indo-European. And then there were the Mitanni and the Hittites, and they're Indo-European. So there's that influence as well.
Yeah.
They're Indian. In 1500 BC, we have Indians in the region speaking Vedic, or with Vedic gods, and they're merging with the Egyptians. And so, you know, their ideas, Indian ideas, are making it into Egyptian religion as well. But you have these Semite tribes that are constantly fighting amongst each other, all this internecine battling. So that is being reflected in the Old Testament. But what we're seeing then is eventually where they say the 12 tribes. Well, that's a convenient number. There's probably many more than that. And some were very small and some were very, you know, it's a whole, it's not quite what you see. The 12 is a later development. That number is clearly based on the zodiac and not necessarily a real phenomenon of a confederation of 12 tribes in the early first millennium. Say around 1000 is when Israel starts to form as a separate group of people in the hill country, which is between the coastline and the Jordan River. You have the Judean hill country in the south and the Samaritan hill country in the north, Samaria. The archaeology is telling us this is where the Israelites developed. That region is not occupied by settlers until that time, around 1050 or so. There's been a great upheaval in the region with the invasion of sea peoples who have destroyed the Canaanite cities. They've slaughtered thousands. They've driven thousands out of their homes. Mm-hmm. They've caused a lot of trouble for the Egyptians. They've basically ended Egyptian domination of the region. At that point is where you start seeing this new confederation of tribes arising in the hill country. So it wasn't a conquest. It was this kind of refugee status that developed this this group of people. And
Is it kind of a coming into like some kind of city environment at this point, or is it still very kind of nomadic and ready to uproot and leave if necessary kind of situation?
Well, we know that the city of Jerusalem had been founded. I think they found remains because it's dating back like 6,000 years. I can't remember the exact figure there, but it's certainly very old, some parts, the earliest strata that were of occupation. And then during the second millennium, the Amorites are in that region after like the 16th century. And they're accredited significantly with founding Jerusalem. So the Hyksos, you know, there's this whole Hyksos connection. The Hyksos are basically Amorites, and they are a collection of different tribes of Semites who are significantly nomadic, and they, you know, move into the Delta region and then are expelled, but not because of religious reasoning. They were expelled. Well, one thing, apparently they had a whole leper colony going on. It was like, you know, this may be where the problems with pigs and swine come in. They're calling it leprosy, but it may have been trichinosis. And then, you know,
the kosher development occurs right there. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think because there's a enclave culture developing that, you know, they somehow acquired trichinosis, and they think it comes from being associated with dirty people, and so now they got to make themselves right with their gods. And and by the way, the Hyksos god main god was Baal Seth. It wasn't Yahweh. So these are not the Israelites.
Right.
They are proto-Israelites. Baal Seth is a combination of the Canaanite god Baal and the Egyptian god Seth. And so that shows this kind of interesting merger that influenced the Bible. And it's very important information. But they end up in the Levant. They found Jerusalem significantly as a city anyway. They're called later the Jebusites. And then you have, you know, you come to the first millennium where these apparently hill settlers are saying, hey, we want that city. Because that city, in fact, had a very strategic place, location. If you wanted to go towards east, you wanted that location. And so these hill tribes said, you know, this, and they're related to the people who founded Jerusalem. So the same kind of Amoritish Hyksos tribes, Shasu, Hapiru, with all these mixture, they're all in that area. And then, but an older stratum of them had already founded Jerusalem. And then when these later hill settlers take over the hill country, they're eyeing the city you know, saying, hey, let's go take it. And that's where these Israelite founding stories really come in with King David, and he supposedly takes over Jerusalem, and then, you know, the rest is so-called history.
Right.
But not really.
Now, of course, it's just, I mean, there's so many details to this and things we need to discuss and kind of try to get out here. I obviously want to talk about some of the basic concept in the story that we hear about some of the things that happened event-wise. You know, obviously, you touched a little bit on the burning bush and also the rod of serpent, but there's, like, you know, the 10 plagues, the unleavened bread, the manna. You have the 10 commandments in itself, the golden calf, the Ark of the Covenant, etc. All these fascinating things that occur within the mythology that we need to talk about as well. But why don't we take a short little break here at this point and wrap up the first segment, Asharya, and then, of course, we're going to give out some of the details as well. I want to know where people can go to buy a copy of the book if they want to read more about it. Please tell us your websites and how people can, you know, get a hold of you, and if there's any other online social networking sites or whatnot that you want to give out as well.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the easiest place to find the book is just didmosesexist.com. And that'll take you to to where the book is available. It is soon going to be in Kindle, which is quite a challenge because it has 126 images. Oh. Some of those are maps. And then there's a map. I created a handcrafted map for this whole thing. So that's where you go. There's also my website, truthbeknown.com, and then I have stellarhousepublishing.com, freethoughtnation.com. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook all the time, and sometimes Google+. So I'm people can ask me questions, and they do. So I'm available.
Well, great. Perfect. Yeah, that's awesome. DidMosesExist.com, of course, stellarhousepublishing.com, freethoughtnation.com, and truthbeknown.com. A couple of websites for you there to check out. And yeah, we'll pick up here and continue to talk more about Moses and if he indeed did exist. So we'll be right back. Stay with us, Asharya. We'll be back after this.